Imagine if a terrorist with a gun came in here, with the power to take you away. How would you feel? I would have very cold feet. But here, the will to live, the strongest instinct in life, is overturned by something transcendental. That impressed me. In evaluating this survey, it's worth remembering that doctors and nurses are trained scientific observers of the sick, not people one would imagine giving easy credence to claims of paranormal activity in hospital wards. Ozis and Haraldson find evidence for life after death in this survey. In their final paragraph, they say the central tendencies of the data support the afterlife hypothesis, which they define as the transition to another mode of existence. When the researchers were asking Indian medical staff about apparitions, they met a doctor who was not an onlooker but a patient in a remarkable experience. Dr. Banu Iyengar is a hospital pathologist, and this is the story she told me in Delhi. I was very ill in hospital and I wasn't conscious of much going on around me at the time. I had a temperature of about 106°F/41.1°C. I was being visited by my mother and a student named Kirti. While I was lying there, I suddenly saw Kirti's grandfather coming in. He was not a very tall person, he had on very thick spectacles and was wearing his usual dhoti. I recognized him because he was dressed as he was when he used to come to pick up Kirti. He stood at the foot of the bed and kept saying, "Please send my granddaughter back. Send my child home." He was very persistent and I got a little irritable. I turned over onto my other side, but he still stood there and said, "Please send the child home." When he persisted, I decided to tell Kirti to go home. I didn't mention that her grandfather was waiting, because I obviously thought she had seen him too. She told me she wouldn't go home because I was too unwell and she would like to stay with me. There was some argument, and I told her she should at least telephone. She made a call and came running back into the ward, very upset. She had been told that about 5 minutes before her call, her grandfather had died. So she went rushing home. I was so ill I didn't say anything to her about her grandfather. Later, I realized he had actually come to call her, perhaps as he was about to die. At the time, I really thought he was standing there. On thinking it over, there seemed two or three possibilities. As a doctor, one doesn't really think that apparitions happen, so one imagines maybe it was due to my high temperature, or perhaps I had a delirium or an hallucination. It was a very strange coincidence that just at his point of death, I should see the apparition of him standing by my bedside. It's very difficult to explain, there is no scientific explanation for it. Dr. Iyengar's mother was there that day at the hospital with Kirti. She told us what she remembered. I was sitting on the bed when she asked Kirti to go home and she was quite strict about it. When the girl refused, she asked her to telephone the house. When the girl came back, she told my daughter her grandfather had died a few minutes before. I told my daughter it was a very good thing she was very strict. She told me she had seen the grandfather by her bedside and that was why she had watched Kirti to go home. Kirti's grandfather was very fond of her. Sometimes you can see people just before this kind of thing. I believe she saw him because I believe that people, just after death, sometimes have the power to reach and convey a message. The grandmother was all alone at home, so naturally, the grandfather might have appeared to summon the granddaughter. According to the surveys, if you see an apparition, it is likely to be in broad daylight and will be someone you know, probably a man, who has just died a violent or sudden death. It's possible that you may already have seen a ghost and never realized it. The vast majority of sightings are by people who have no idea the person they saw was dead. About 1 in 4 of us can expect knowingly to see an apparition, or at least have some contact with a dead person, according to the 1990 Gallup poll on the subject. Nowadays, scientific research into apparitions is concerned more with statistics than sensational, individual cases. Parapsychologists look for a pattern, something to provide a theory to link with other branches of science. A recent survey, Encounters with the Dead, written by Professor Haraldson in 1989, dented a few myths, with its analysis of 450 apparitions in Iceland. More than half the apparitions were seen in daylight or under full electric light, contradicting traditional ghost story sightings at dead of night. About a third were seen at twilight, and only one apparition in 10 appeared in darkness. The spirits of the dead don't seem as afraid of the light as many mediums, who work in darkness, have claimed. Most people recognized the apparition they saw. Usually it was a dead relative. Only one person in 60 saw a total stranger. 8 out of 10 who saw apparitions had no idea the person was dead or dying. Haraldson told me of an example which impressed him. A woman who worked in a sanatorium knew a patient named Jacob who was sometimes depressed. They became friends, and she suggested, to cheer him up, that he should visit her and her husband for dinner. Jacob agreed and promised to come next day. During the night, I wake up and all strength is taken away from me. I am unable to move. Suddenly I see the bedroom door open, and on the threshold stands Jacob with his face all covered with blood. I am unable to speak or move. Then he disappears, and it felt as if he had closed the door behind him. I became my normal self and told my husband about the incident. I said, I can swear that something has happened at the sanatorium. The woman telephoned first thing in the morning and was told Jacob had committed suicide in the night. But what is an apparition? What causes it? Scientific analysis of apparitions is not new. Modern research started in 1886 with 2 large volumes of Phantasms of the Living by Edmund Gurney, Frederick W. H. Myers, and Frank Podmore. These founders of the Society for Psychical Research investigated hundreds of cases and launched a debate about their cause that continues to this day. Gurney believed apparitions were due to telepathy by the person who sees the specter. It is psi power by a living mind, able to access information from a distance. Podmore too believed the best explanation was telepathy. On the other hand, Myers felt the person seen as the apparition was the key player, or person, perhaps dying or even dead, who was somehow able to project a message in the shape of an apparition. Myers' view supported the possibility of survival after death, whereas Gurney and Podmore explained it all by telepathy in a living mind. The same debate goes on today. Dr. Charles R. Norton, pioneer of Ganzfeld, told me that psi powers might explain all the phenomena which people take as evidence for survival, the same idea as Gurney but 100 years afterwards. A different view was taken by Professor Ian Stevenson of the University of Virginia. Link and no link, he says motivation is the key factor in deciding who might be the cause of an apparition. Does the person who sees it have overwhelming cause to seek information about someone else by psychic means? Or does the person who is seen as an apparition have outstanding cause to try to pass a message about himself? The evidence seems to support the second idea in many cases. Dr. Stevenson analyzed more than 300 apparitions from Gurney and Myers' Phantasms of the Living and found that violence and sudden death had ended the lives of more than half the people seen as apparitions. He concluded, I suggest that the feature of suddenness increases motivation on the part of the agents to communicate the desperate situation in which they find themselves to persons they think likely to be interested. Persons who die more slowly have adequate time in which to communicate normally. Dr. Stevenson cited some well-known apparitions who clearly had a strong desire to pass on information. The poet Dante, for example, is supposed to have appeared after death to his son, and beckoned him to where Dante had hidden the final cantos of the Divine Comedy. Dante's son, it was said, did not know his father had written the cantos. Stevenson said some apparitions could be caused by the person who saw the specter, whereas others, at least in part, resulted from the activity of deceased or dying persons who may be regarded in some sense as present where they are seen. Dr. Haraldson also entered the long-running Gurney, Myers debate about the motivational force behind apparitions. In his survey, a third of people who were seen as apparitions had died violently or suddenly. And those apparitions who suffered a violent death were strong communicators. Haraldson said, this finding gives considerable support to Myers' theory and the popular belief that the apparition of the dead person plays an active role in the encounter. As a step further, one might ask if suffering a violent death makes contact with the living more desirable or easier. Sometimes the motivation for an apparition seemed to be to prevent the death of others by giving a warning. Icelandic fishermen, who took part in the survey, provided good examples. A teenager out fishing in a small boat heard a voice say, "Leave the fishing line and row ashore." Just as he got back to harbor, a storm blew up and the young man barely managed to reach the dock. He associated the voice with the recently drowned brother. In another case, the crew of a fishing boat were sleeping at night when they were woken early by an urgent voice telling them to get up. This happened twice. Some members of the crew were roused and found a dynamo in the engine room beginning to catch fire. A possible fatal explosion at sea had been averted. Dr. Haraldson's survey asked more than 80 questions and came to a clear conclusion. Our new large collection of cases strongly indicates that the prevailing academic attitude that experiences of this kind are just hallucinations, appears unsatisfactory. Many of the cases revealed to us dramatic intrusions of meaningful imagery into consciousness. The crucial question is, where do these intrusions come from? Who initiates these echoes of the dead? Many of our cases point to an active role of the agent, particularly cases involving persons who have suffered violent death. The best cases have some features that may best be explained by accepting some form of a survivalist theory. Many non-scientists may find statistical evidence less convincing than individual cases. There are many stories of apparitions attested by good witnesses. At the end of the 19th century, one of the most stringent fraud hunters in the history of psychical research investigated a classic case, a murder trial dominated by evidence about an apparition of the victim. Dr. Richard Hodgson of the ASPR first read about it in the Chicago Evening Journal of the 3rd of July 1897, under the headline "Queer Evidence Convicts." The report said that a coroner's jury had recorded a verdict of death by heart disease of a woman found dead in her home. But after the funeral, the dead woman's mother saw visions of her daughter, a Mrs. Hsu, who insisted she had been strangled by her husband. The mother was given such convincing details of the murder by the apparitions that she persuaded the authorities to exhume the body. The husband was tried for first-degree murder, convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment. To verify this story, Hodgson got written statements from the mother, a Mrs. Hester, and 7 witnesses who said they were told all about the visions before the crime was ever proved. Hodgson also corresponded with the prosecuting assistant district attorney and secured transcripts of official trial records. In court, Mrs. Hester said it all began after the daughter's funeral when I prayed for her to come back to tell me all about her death. The dead woman then appeared 4 times to her mother and described how Mr. Hsu arrived home for his evening meal on the day she died. He was mad. I had not cooked any meat. But I had butter, apples, cherries and 3 kinds of jellies and plenty on the table. There was a quarrel and the apparition of Mrs. Hsu said her husband took her pictures from the wall and piled them and ornaments and clothes into a basket where wool was kept. One of the jurors wrote to Hodgson that this was where the items were eventually discovered. Mrs. Hester, an elderly lady, told the court how her daughter described the murder. "Ma, he just took his hands and squeezed my neck off." The old lady was asked if she might have been dreaming. She replied she was going to bed when she first saw her daughter by firelight. "I felt her arm to see if it was real. It was flesh and blood." Cross-examined, Mrs. Hester added, "When she came, I got up on my elbows and reached out a little further as I wanted to see if people came in their coffins. I wanted to see if there was a coffin and there was not. She was just like she was when she left this world. I wanted her to come to talk to me and she did." For weeks Mrs. Hester tried to persuade the authorities to open her daughter's grave. 2 things made them take her seriously. The clothes she said her daughter wore when she saw her were those she had worn on the day of her death. And Mrs. Hester, who had never visited her daughter's home, gave a description of the crime which matched the layout of the house. Eventually, the old lady was allowed to take the sheriff's men to the house. A juror wrote, Mrs. Hester went with them to the house and showed the way through the doors as directed by Mrs. Hsu. She stopped at the last door and pointed out to the men with her the exact spot as directed, and there they found blood and signs of a scuffle on the floor, although she had never seen the house before. Mrs. Hester told the court, "I saw the place just exactly as she told me, and I saw blood right there, where she told me. I never laid eyes on that house until since her death. She told me all this before I knew anything of those buildings at all." Witnesses testified that before the body was exhumed, Mrs. Hester gave more details about the cause of death. Mrs. Hester reported that her daughter had said, "It was the last joint and he squeezed it until it was all bloody." When Mrs. Hsu's body was examined, the first joint of the neck was found to be broken, between the atlas and axis vertebrae. A juror who attended the exhumation and postmortem wrote, "Upon examination, we found every iota just as Mrs. Hester told several others and myself beforehand. The apparition of Mrs. Hsu seemed motivated by a desire for justice and revenge. She was also more than a little annoyed about the unfair accusation that she gave her husband a poor meal on the night of the murder." Mrs. Hester said, "She told me something about that meal every night she came. She came four times, four nights dash, but the second night she told me that her neck was squeezed off at the first joint, and it was just as she told me." The assistant district attorney admitted to Hodgson that the vision, dream or whatever it was responsible for the trial because it had prompted the exhumation of the body and the post-mortem examination. Did the husband get a fair trial? An apparition's version of events was heard in court almost as if it was Mrs. Hsu herself giving evidence. The prosecutor admitted, "The court instructed the jury of its own motion that the vision was not evidence to be considered. But I have ever thought it made an impression on the jury unfavorable to the prisoner." Chapter 13. The Ghost of Operation Stone Age. We are both onlookers and actors in the great drama of existence. Neil Spoer. A phantom warning of imminent danger that triggered a naval action in the Second World War was the most powerful story to emerge from a simple experiment. I asked a few friends and acquaintances if they had ever had a supernatural experience. It was a way of testing the claim, implicit in Gallup and other surveys, that many more people experience the paranormal than is generally realized. I expected to hear one or two run-of-the-mill stories of strange happenings. Instead, there was a flood of testimony about apparitions, precognitive dreams and near-death experiences, a few of which I was able partially to verify. None of these anecdotes prove the paranormal, but they confirm that people's lives are spiritually and psychically richer and more complicated than I had imagined. A close friend, Tegwin Hughes, told me the story of an incident aboard HMS Ryan, a British warship in the Second World War. Tegwin died on Easter Monday 1991, 6 months after writing this account. The November 1942 convoy from Alexandria to Malta had secured from the usual precautionary, sunset action stations, and darkness was closing in. Our guns were on standby for another night at sea. Aboard HMS Ryan, one of the escort cruisers, the petty officer who did the post-action station rounds left the cramped space of our transmitting station, TS, again assaulting our eardrums with the change of pressure as he lifted, slammed down and clipped shut the counterweighted 400-weight hatch above us. Our 9-man crew shuffled around like dogs, each one settling down on his bit of deck space for another night of waiting for the dawn. On that ship, no one left his action station for more than a few seconds at a time. Between alarms we only relaxed. Soon each vanished behind his section of the T.S. table, a 7 feet long, 3 feet high compact mass of electrical and mechanical instruments for passing information, from several sources, to the port and starboard 4-inch gun batteries on deck. The chatter died out and we all settled down to read, write letters, or doze in the narrow space between table and bulkhead. Everyone did a trick in turn on one or another of the headphones. As number one on the table, I sat at the end, under the hatch, with my left shoulder jammed against the side of the vertical ladder, my upper back to the bulkhead and my right elbow on the deck. On that particular night, I hadn't bothered to pass the headphones around the side of the table to Abel Seaman Taft James. I half lay back and relaxed to read, aware that the chat on the phones had stopped. All was silent, except for the creaking of the ship as she zigzagged towards Grand Harbor, Malta. The night dragged on. Some time later, came a rush of noise, as the heat of our transmitting station met the cool air up top and I heard the hatch slam open. Then the hurried scraping of boots on the vertical steel ladder, and the ear-hurting thump as whoever it was swung the hatch cover down after him, and clipped it shut. I didn't bother to look up. All visitors were a nuisance. The footsteps drew level with my shoulders and I glanced left as the last two rungs to the deck were negotiated. There were no feet, no legs. A quick upward look confirmed, nobody was there. Taft James' face peered around the table at deck level, mouthing the words, "Who's that?" Another face from behind the large deflector screen at the far end of the table asked the same question. I didn't reply. I was already upright, reacting instinctively, calling out over the headphones the order, "All guns close up." Our T.S. crew was now closed up, waiting, alert, listening for something and hearing only the equipment and the sound of clothes rustling. The seconds stretched out towards the hoped for tomorrow. Into that strange silence, came a muffled shout over my headphones. Could that be the masthead lookout, I thought incredulously? He was more than seven decks above me, high up in the crow's nest. He shouldn't be able to contact me, but who else could it be? I held back my shout of repeat as the words filtered through, hovering on the edge of audibility. Aircraft in the starboard bow pause, bearing green, 40. The T.S. transmitting station crew watched me calmly, hearing nothing. I responded with the order. Starboard battery, red barrage, red load, load, load. The lieutenant, high above the bridge, wondered how all his starboard gun-ready lamps were burning. Showing the guns loaded, no alarms had sounded and no orders had gone from the director or the bridge to the T.S. or the guns. But he had heard the clatter from the gun deck, so he asked no questions. He fired the salvo. On short fuses, the exploding shells lit up and shook the attacking Italian torpedo bombers. They lifted with the blast, and the first Fischer torpedoes went deep before leveling out. From the opening of the hatch to the first salvo had taken only a few seconds. Now, over the noise of the guns as we swung to starboard and increased speed, came a high-pitched hum which climbed steadily. "Torpedoes," whispered Taft James. "Shut up," I said, looking around the tensed crew. The sweat dripped from the end of my nose onto the plot, a chart moving slowly from one roller to the other, forecasting the enemy's course. Time went into the standing still routine again, long seconds crawling by. The snarl of the torpedo became a scream as it came in under the hull immediately below us. Then the sound dropped to a loud hum, fading rapidly, as the Doppler effect confirmed that the fish had missed its target, passing under the ship. Someone on the guns called out that another torpedo had crossed the bow, missing by a few yards. A minute later, we heard and felt the shock of an explosion. We thought we'd been hit astern, but it was less than the cruiser Arethusa that had been torpedoed. She survived, badly damaged, with the loss of many of her ship's company. A few days later, the Orion arrived safely back at Alexandria and moored up. As we crawled out through the T.S. hatch, I reached down under the deckhead and turned off the light. I looked down into the silent darkness, and thought about the crew which had manned the T.S. before us. We had known all along that on a previous voyage, the ship had been hit several times. Bombs and fire had fused the metal of the hatch and the deck, and cracked the fuel tanks. The sealed up T.S. had slowly filled with oil and fumes. No one could get through the wreckage to rescue the men of the T.S. transmitting station. They controlled the chute as long as they could, but gradually all suffocated. Looking into the darkness, I wondered, did someone? Did they? If that strange warning hadn't come, If the guns hadn't fired and the enemy aircraft hadn't lifted, would that torpedo have passed under us? As seafarers, we didn't look too closely at the workings of fate. The look might be taken as a challenge. A fascinating story of an apparition whose timely warning saved the 9-man crew of the T.S. from the fate of their predecessors, all killed in the Battle of Crete. An apparition, never seen, but whose presence was felt by at least 3 members of the T.S. crew. The phenomena included a warning voice, heard by Teguin alone over his headphones. Stories of apparitions telling of imminent danger are not unknown amongst seafarers, but what about straightforward, historical facts? The war records of the cruisers Orion and Arethusa confirm the basic outline of Teguin's compelling narrative, as I discovered from the Naval Section of the Ministry of Defence and the Public Record Office at Kew, London. Simply stated, Teguin's account says that sometime after Orion went to sunset action stations, she was attacked by enemy torpedo bombers but emerged unscathed. Her sister ship Arethusa was badly damaged and suffered casualties. The story of Wednesday, 18th of November, 1942 is told in the dog-eared pages of the ship's log of HMS Orion. She joined the convoy at sea early that morning and at 17.25 hours that winter's evening, took up her station in the night screen of warships guarding the convoy. A naval spokesman confirmed that the ship would certainly have been on sunset action stations at that time. A handwritten entry told what happened 40 minutes later. 18.05 hours. Enemy aircraft. Attacked by torpedoes. Arethusa hit and hauled out of screen. Courses as requisite to take avoiding action. Other documents from the Ministry of Defense painted the full picture of this assault upon a historic convoy, codename Operation Stone Age, which was attempting to break the German and Italian blockade of the British-held island of Malta. North of Benghazi on the coast of Libya, Orion, a 7,000-ton cruiser with 4- and 6-inch guns, had been the first in the convoy to come under attack from Italian torpedo bombers. Orion escaped, but another cruiser, Arethusa, was hit and there were 155 casualties from a massive explosion. HMS Bethard towed the crippled Arethusa back to Alexandria for repairs. Despite these losses, Operation Stone Age was a success. The rest of the convoy and the gauntlet of aircraft and submarines and brought badly needed supplies to the beleaguered garrison, which held out throughout the war, against everything the German and Italian air forces could throw at them. The British awarded Malta the George Cross Medal, to mark the collective bravery of its inhabitants. A vital postscript to Teguin's narrative is his knowledge that the previous crew of the 4-inch transmitting station aboard Orion had been killed in the Battle of Crete. This was confirmed by Admiralty documents and the ship's log for Thursday, May 29, 1941, when the British Navy were desperately trying to evacuate thousands of troops from the Cretan port of Heraklion, during the Allied withdrawal from the island. Under constant attack from German dive bombers, British ships were sitting targets as they ferried off the soldiers. The destroyer Imperial, flagship of Rear Admiral Henry Rawlings, was sunk and so was the destroyer Hayard. The cruisers Dido and Decoy were crippled. Rawlings transferred his flag to the Orion, whose decks were crowded with over 1,000 exhausted troops, many wounded. Later that May morning, German dive bombers scored 2 direct hits on Orion within 2 hours. There were explosions, fire and flooding. Over 100 crewmen died, including almost certainly all the men of the 4-inch TS Orion's captain was killed and Rear Admiral Rawlings seriously wounded. Of the evacuated troops, who may have thought they had reached safety aboard the cruiser, 260 were killed and another 280 wounded. The Admiralty's detailed report of the attack says that after several near misses, causing damage to fuel lines, Orion took its first direct hit from a heavy bomb just after 9 o'clock in the morning. But most damage was done nearly 2 hours later, when a second heavy bomb, with a delayed action fuse, passed through the upper bridge and exploded within the ship. Blast effect severe. All personnel in the lower steering position and in the vicinity, over 200 in all, were killed. Engine room telegraphs and steering gear were out of action, and the ship began to turn in circles and took a list of 11 degrees to starboard.